Let's get started. Thank you for joining. We're class two of our bad guys of the Bible. I think it's interesting that it's actually most of the that negative characters of the Bible are men. Not that there are no female bad women of the Bible, but primarily they seem to be bad male characters, with a few exceptions of queens here and there. If I were to ask you today, we're going to talk about Ishmael and Esav, which happens to be like the exact parshas that we're reading in the Torah right now. I didn't schedule it with that intent, but if I were to ask you how bad are they, and ask you to answer like on a scale of 1 to 10, before I ask you, I'm going to ask it in two versions. How bad are they if you just read the simple psukim, the simple verses of the Torah? Let's see, like, any suggestions on a scale of 1 to 10 where 1 is very righteous and 10 is very bad?
I wouldn't say the same. I think Esav is worse than Ishmael.
Okay. Esav's worse than Ishmael? Yeah. I'm just curious, like a straw poll.
No, I think it's the other way. Esav is not really a bad guy, okay. I don't think, you know. Ishmael, what did he do? I was taught that he would tease his brother.
Okay.
You know, and was nasty to him, although it's not written here.
We'll get there.
Okay.
I feel bad for Ishmael.
You feel bad for Ishmael, right?
Well,
okay.
You can't compare them because Esav,
yeah, let's abandon the straw poll. That was clearly not a good idea.
Esav, you see, as a young man, and then as a much older person.
Uh-huh.
Whereas Ishmael, you only see him as a kid.
No, but you see predictions of what he's going to be, but it almost sounds like he's like impulsive, and it's not he's trying to be bad, he just can't help himself.
Because of his father.
So we're going to get into a lot of this, and we're actually, what Don just said, we will actually see that play into the commentaries as well. But what I think is really helpful and important when we study these stories is to kind of distinguish between how our midrashic lens understands these figures and how the text itself understands these figures. I think there's tremendous depth and truth to the midrash and to the commentaries that are based on the midrashim. But they have a specific, for lack of a better term, agenda. They have a specific methodology. They're trying to elaborate on things that they might have found in the verses themselves. But to go back to something I think we said last time, and to believe in Midrash is totally literal, or maybe I said this on Monday, to believe in Midrash as something that's entirely literal is not good on the one hand, and to believe it as totally invalid on the other hand is also not true. The Midrash is supposed to be understood. This is how my personal view, not everyone agrees with this. I believe Midrash is something that's supposed to be viewed as teaching us lessons, but not in necessarily a literal sense. So we're going to see this play out. What I will say is, if you asked the rabbis of the Midrash, how bad was Esav or how bad was Ishmael, the answer is very, very, very bad. Right. They're really, in our Midrashic texts, laid out as extremely evil figures. We'll see this play itself out. So part of what I want to ask tonight is, first of all, where was that coming from? Where does that emerge from? What were the motivations behind the rabbis who took those positions? And if we were to kind of go back to the simple text itself, what would we actually see? And what's the connection between the Midrash, the Midrash on one hand, and the Peshuto Shulmaker, the simple reading, on the other? That's what I'd like to do tonight. These stories, as we already saw, are multi-layered and multifaceted. Right? There's so many different possible reasons, and many of them are probably true, and they're probably all interplaying at the same time. Just like when there's a conflict between two people in our lives, right? There's never one reason for a conflict, or I would at least say there's more often than not one reason, but there are lots of layers of reasons, and often there are years of built-up tensions that can lead into a conflict. And that's true in the Torah as well. There are multifaceted reasons for why conflict exists. So what I'd like to start with is with the life of Ishmael. We'll talk about Ishmael, and then we'll go forward and talk about Esav. And then we'll actually see that the two lives, at least in the Midrashic mind, are quite actually interlinked. The two people speak to each other and are part of a conversation for the rabbis of the Mishnah. And the reverberations of Ishmael and Esav have lasted for centuries, if not millennia, throughout our commentaries, but even according to some of our rabbis, till today, these reverberations go on. So without further ado, I'll just summarize very quickly the story of Ishmael, just so we're more or less on the same page. Feel free to pause me to disagree with anything I'm about to say. If I had a 30-page source sheet, we could go through all the text inside, but I figure we would just summarize. So Ishmael is born to Hagar. Hagar is unclear, really, either the concubine or the wife of Avraham, but not the first wife, the second wife. So Avraham is first, originally Avram, and married to Sarai. And eventually, the two of them cannot have children. Sarai says, here, take Hagar. And actually, some of the commentaries say that when she says take her, that's full kiddushin, because the word lakach, the word to take, actually means to get married in a full way. So she was no longer a concubine. She became a full wife, but a second wife. And then the text at that point says, and Sarah became lowered in the eyes of Hagar, right? So who's responsible for what is eventually going to happen? We'll see. There's probably enough blame to go around. We'll get there.
But she hasn't worked for Sarah before.
Before that, she had been Sarah's maiden, right, or maidservant. So she becomes no longer a maidservant, potentially, gets married, becomes pregnant immediately. Sarah is lowered in her status. And then Sarah gets angry and basically says, kick her out. And I think I forget this year after year, but Hagar is actually exiled twice.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's the first exile. She's kicked out once when she's pregnant. Mm-hmm. And then God basically says, go back, and tells Abraham, like, take her back in. And then Ishmael is born. We'll get to what his name comes from. He's born. He grows up until what age? Anyone know? Like, how long does he stay in the household for? Until 13. So 13 is the covenant between Avram and God and the Brit Baim Sarim, the covenant between the parts. That's when we get the commandment of circumcision. Ishmael is circumcised, and then I think it's the next chapter that the conflict starts again, and Ishmael is kicked out of the house.
Right, they're both circumcised at the same time.
Avraham and Ishmael are circumcised at the same time. Yeah. It seems like they're circumcised. Then Sarah gets pregnant, has Yitzchak, and something in the moment between her having Yitzchak and Ishmael being a young boy, maybe 13, maybe a little bit older, or I guess a teenager, she says, I don't want this kid around my son. God says to Avram, listen to your wife, and Ishmael is kicked out for the second time.
Did she say around my son or just around here?
I think she says around my son.
Oh.
Okay. And from that point on, we actually don't see a whole lot of Ishmael in the Torah anymore. There's not like this kind of brewing conflict with Ishmael and Yitzchak the same way that there will be one generation down between Esav and Yaakov.
Joseph was sold to Ishmaelites.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so those are probably the descendants of Ishmael. And they became already at that point two generations later, right? They'd become a significant tribe. And which is actually part of the promise that is given to Ishmael, that Ishmael will become this great nation. This is even after. This is a promise that God makes to Hagar, the second exile, when Ishmael is about to die because of thirst. Right? God appears to her. There's water that's given. And he says, this child will become a great nation. So I think, anyone want to add anything to that story?
Avraham dies, Ishmael comes back to bury him.
Yeah.
And seems to be more pleasant at that point.
Right. So I'll start with this question now that we're there. Was Ishmael at any point in the Pshuto Shel Mikra, in the simple reading of the verses, did Ishmael do anything unpleasant or untoward?
Well, it doesn't say.
Right. It doesn't necessarily say that he did anything wrong. Let's now jump into the verse for this discussion. Like, what do we see about Ishmael that
like
might
playing,
be untoward?
He was like playing when Sarah was watching. Was
we'll
like
get
playing.
Great. We'll get there. Awesome. So let's do verse sources 1 and 2 now. Robin, do you want to start us off?
Sure.
We'll go in order.
From there, she
Yeah, Bereshit chapter 16.
The angel of the Lord said to her further, "Behold, you are with child and shall bear a son. You shall call him Ishmael, for the Lord has paid heed to your suffering. He shall be a wild ass of a man, his hand against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. He shall dwell alongside of all his kinsmen."
So that last verse there is an extremely difficult pasuk to translate. And the translation here, this is from Sepharia, is the best that it can be, but it's an extremely hard verse to translate. Let's start with what is a little bit simpler. We know what his name means. Yishmael comes from, very clearly, the verb of shama, he has heard. Shama Hashem, who has heard what? Whenever you do this in like elementary school Hebrew grammar, there's always like, mi amar lemi, who said what to who? And so here, it's God as a subject heard, and that's why Shama El, God heard, or Yishma, God will hear, or God hears. And what does God hear? The suffering of Hagar. And that's where the name comes from. We're going to see that these names, in some of our Midrashic thought, are going to play a very central role to the metaphysical stature of these nations.
Suffering from
as we go forward.
Hagar was suffering because because of her work?
Seems to be suffering because of her her status in the household. That seems to be the obvious suffering in there. I'm just going to take the second verse that Robin read and just go through the Hebrew, because it's worth pointing out how difficult it is to translate. So, v'hu yiyeh pere adam. He will be a pere, whatever that means, man. And pere, I don't know if it's hapax legomenon, which is my favorite Latin term for hapax legomenon is when a word or a term only appears once in the Bible. And that is difficult, both for classic commentaries and contemporary commentaries, because if you don't have other context for how a root is used, you don't really know what it means.
So that shorash doesn't exist?
I am not aware of it in other contexts. It could be it does. But all the commentaries are kind of less defined connected terms, like parai. But the word, at least the term pere adam, as far as I know, doesn't appear elsewhere in Chumash.
How do you spell paro?
With an ayin and a hey.
Okay.
It's interesting. Listen, if we were the Maharal of Prague, who says that if you have two out of the three root letters in a word, you can still connect them in terms of meaning, I'm not the Maharal. It's like a step above my pay grade. Para, some people assume, means just wilderness. And while here it's translated as wild ass as a man, there are other commentaries who read this as he's a man who lives in the desert, who lives out in places not around civilization. Then maybe the reading here is Ishmael is someone who's going to live a little bit of a secluded life. It's not coincidental that one of the core moments of Ishmael's life is actually being kicked out into the desert, right, and finding God in the desert where God gives him a prophecy. If you want to read into this even more, and some later commentaries do, Ishmaelites, right, if you think about Islam having taken over, primarily live in arid desert climates. So maybe there's some connection there between desert, the wilderness, and Ishmael. So I'll just suggest that for now. So he's a pere adam, and then this is even more difficult as difficult. Yado bakol, v'yad kol bo. His hand in everything, and the hand of everything within him. V'al pnei chol echav yishkon, and he will live upon or on the face of all of his brethren.
Against or facing, like against?
Al pnei, on the face. I'm just trying to be very literal now, with offering as little of my personal commentary as possible. But it is worth reading Rashi. Rashi is always our starting point. And so, Mike, why don't you read Rashi here on source 2?
In English, you mean?
Yeah, read Rashi in English.
Okay.
This is Sepharia's translation of Rashi.
Okay, wild man. One who loves the open spaces to hunt wild animals, as it is written of him, and he dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer.
Okay, so I'll just pause you there. How is Rashi, what's Rashi's methodology for explaining the words pere adam, which loosely will translate as wild person, wild man? Rashi doesn't quote any other context of pere, but he can't find any, So what does he do? He says, oh, it must be connected to something we're going to learn about Ishmael later. Right? Later, five chapters from now, we'll see that Ishmael lives in the Midbar, or settles in the Midbar. That must be what para means here. Just normally, methodologically, if a commentator can find a proof, this is a very weak kind of proof. I think it just goes to show how difficult it is to translate this. That he's not quoting another expression of para. He's saying, oh, later on, we're going to learn this about Ishmael, and that's probably what it means here, too. Okay, so keep going.
His hand shall be against everyone, a highwayman.
Okay, yeah, so it's, again, the Hebrew, I actually don't love this translation. Yado bakol, if you were translating that in a very literal sense, his hand is in everything. Right, so highwayman here, again, I don't like that translation, I apologize.
Well, kol can refer to everything or can refer to everyone also, right?
His hand in all. Let's be even like more kind of generic in our translation. His hand in all. So Rashi says, listim. What does that mean? Listim are highway robbers. I don't know. Does the term highwayman mean the same thing? I'm not.
I don't think it exists. Not
well, yeah.
Okay.
It's an old term. The Tennyson poem,
yeah.
Wonderful poem.
This,
romantic poem.
So Savaria, which is this amazing online resource, they basically work with, they either are gifted copyrights to translations, or they take translations that are old enough that the copyrights have expired. So that might be what's going on here. It's a very old translation. I personally think if you're hunting for translations of Rashi online, the best online translation of Rashi I can find that's free is on the Chabad website. Mm-hmm. Everyone's got to find their sources, but I just didn't have time to click on multiple websites. So here Rashi says his hand in all highway robbers or robbers, listim. Listim are the same. It's the same term you see throughout the Talmud. As an example, Reish Lakish, I believe, is referred to. He was the head of the listim, the head of the bandits, before he meets Rabbi Yochanan and is kind of remedied to the way of the Torah. So you see it's a common Mishnaic era term. Okay, so he's going to be a robber. And Viyad Kolbo, and the hand of all within him. So Mike, read that again.
And everyone's hand against him. Everyone will hate him and attack him.
Okay, so he's going to be both kind of pursuing others and hated and pursued by others. So it seems like the fate of Ishmael is a life of conflict and a life of kind of living just beyond the edge of the law. And this, to my knowledge, this is kind of one of the early, not chronologically, but the early places in the Torah where you see commentaries say, who is Ishmael? Not a wholesome figure.
Was the Rambam familiar with Rashi?
Is the Rambam? I think so.
Because
yeah.
He lives with Arabs, and he could have read this in, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not aware of the Rambam's thinking about Ishmael per se in this context. I know elsewhere the Rambam talks about Islam in a censored piece of the Rambam that got cut out for a few centuries. The Rambam talks about how Islam and Christianity were a divine step in the direction of monotheism, which I think is like an interesting thought. He wrote that in Hilchot Malachim, the Laws of Kings, which is where the Rambam talks about government. And it gets cut out for a few hundred years by censors. So anyways, we can save that for another time. That's the one I referenced the Rambam I'm aware of.
I might jump
yeah.
ahead, but everything you said so far is interchangeable with Asa.
Okay.
Because he's also a highwayman and a riot.
Right. Lord. So we're definitely seeing some parallels between Ishmael and Asa. First of all, just structurally, right, they're and Cain, great.
Except that he was a farmer.
When he killed his brother, then he couldn't be a farmer anymore, and he was a wanderer. And he was worried because people would be against him.
And friends
would be against him.
We spoke last week, to Kirsten's point, about the idea of like biblical echoes, how lots of biblical stories are echoing and mirroring archetypes that existed in earlier stories. And so you definitely see a very clear parallel of two brothers. I think if you're going to compare Cain to anyone, probably the best comparison is Esav and Yaakov, because they're both kind of the only two siblings. Actually, you know what? Let's just go with the three as a comparison. There are midrashim that try to read in that, oh, it must be that just like Cain killed his brother, Ishmael and Esav tried to kill their brothers. So you kind of have echoes in midrashic thinking about there must be some similarities between these people. There are two brothers born to two parents who are very important figures in Bereishit in their respective stories. So there's definitely connections there. And in terms of the Ishmael-Esav connection, just going back to Uli's point, we're going to see a lot of additional parallelism that's created between them. Okay. And the next verse that I want to quote is verse 3. So Uli, why don't you read that
Sarah
for us?
Sarah saw the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had born to Abraham playing.
Okay. So, and I'll read this in Hebrew. This is chapter 21 of Bereishit. Vatirat Sarah et Ben Hagar. Sarah saw the son of Hagar, Hamitzrit the Egyptian. That's probably not a complimentary term here, right?
Well, it's such a redundancy. Not only is she the outsider, the foreigner, she's also the Egyptian.
Right, so we know narrative-wise...
Hagar and the Egyptian.
Right, because you're saying Hagar by her very name means the stranger.
Oh, yeah.
Or the dweller? Or
well, there's often a difference between Gimel Reish, which means to dwell but not to be fully of the place in biblical context. And then on the other hand, you would have Yeshev. Lashevet would mean to kind of dwell in a fixed and permanent way. So that's one thing here that's kind of being pointed out. We know that the Torah doesn't have high things to say about Egyptians. Even though this has happened before, generally we're not such big, there's a tension with the biblical Egyptians. Probably just give me 1 second. And then this is, Sarah sees the son of Hagar the Egyptian, Asher Yaldal Avram, who was born to Abraham. And what's he doing? The operative verb in this verse is mitzachek. And now here, you have the translation of playing. But I just want to pause and point out that this is a difficult thing to translate to.
You mean laughing.
Right? It can mean laughing. Who else is known for their laughing?
Sarah.
When Sarah, and who's named for that?
Yitzchak.
I just want to point out here, there's something connected between the fact that Ishmael, the firstborn son, is laughing, and it uses the same term, laughing or playing, but there's something about him being mitzachek, and the fact that now there's the other younger son in the picture who is Yitzchak. I think that language is intentional, and it's trying to...
So we can't have two mitzachek in the same house. It has to be the other one.
Great. There seems to be this like tension now between the different kinds of mitzachek, the different kinds of laughter or playing. So what is this playing that's going on here? And why would that irk Sarah so much that she then says, this verse precedes Sarah saying, it's time for Hagar to now leave with her teenage son, Ishmael. So what could this mitzachek be that's so bad? So I want to suggest a few possibilities, and then we'll go into the midrashim. Like, just if you're going to take this from a simple approach. One is that there's already been one experience, a tension between Hagar and Sarah, between the co-wives, which is, right, Hagar is elevated. Hagar debases, maybe makes fun of Sarah.
There's evidence of that?
Yeah. Yeah, but Hakel Beinea, she became lowered in her eyes. So I think this was Dr. Nechama Price suggested this, if I'm remembering correctly, that what might be happening here is that Sarah is basically reliving her own personal experience and now saying, oh my gosh, here's a boy who is being mitzachek, who's laughing, maybe who's making fun of my son, just like his mother made fun of me. Maybe that's what's... I'm trying to kind of not delve into the midrashim yet, just to try to understand what is going on here. What's the motive for Sarah to say, get them out? So maybe Sarah is feeling vulnerable from her own personal experience, and that's reflecting now on the next generation down. And she's saying, get him out. I don't want anyone being mitzachek my Yitzchak. Right? Maybe that's the connection here. I don't want anyone... playing around, or maybe here that you would explain this more as making fun of. And so chek, right, can mean to laugh. In other contexts, it means to play. There's a clear linguistic link between mitzachek and and with a tzadi on the one hand, and misachik with a samech on the other. The two verbs are often used interchangeably, and even though more often than not tzchok means laughter, tzchok means play. It's often with a sin, I apologize. So what's going on here? Maybe Yishmael is playing too rough, but maybe Yishmael is making fun of. Maybe Yishmael is putting down. And for Sarah, that could be very triggering, because that's what happened to her.
Or he's molesting.
In her own mind. Yeah. Say that again.
Or he's molesting.
Okay. So let's now kind of enter the Midrashic mind.
But can you just, I just want to say, whenever I've read that section, the way it always disturbed me about Sarah there, and the way I always interpret it, and it might be totally baseless, but it seems sometimes when someone is in a bad state themselves and they see someone else enjoying themselves, they think ill towards the person who's enjoying themselves because they don't want to see someone. It's not a healthy thing at all, but it happens. And that's what how I always...
Who gives you the right to be happy?
Yeah. That's how I always interpreted this when I... It's just me. I could be completely wrong.
I hear.
But that's what it felt like. In my mind,
I think it's fair to say that, of all the kind of texts and commentaries we can look at, these stories are difficult stories, and we're not going to get to the bottom of them necessarily. We're going to be left with questions, and we're not going to cover all possible approaches for what's going on here. I do want to cover, though, kind of the classic rabbinic approach, or a classic rabbinic approach, of why Yishmael is cast as the negative character. I then also want to shine light on a stream of thinking that part of the blame for Yishmael going bad, if we actually assume Yishmael goes bad, is actually on some of the heroes of our story. And you see this line of thinking within our tradition. Before we move on further, the word mitzachek, and this is a classic kind of methodological thing that Midrash will do. Mitzachek, unlike pera, has lots of textual references in the rest of the Bible. Right. And here are three in particular. What is it that the Jews do at Mount Sinai when Moses has gone missing for just one extra day? Right. They tell Aaron, right, take our gold and make for us a calf, a golden calf of gold. And then the verse says, and I'm pre-gaming this. I'm gonna, if it's okay with you, I want to teach this midrash outside. It's actually not a midrash; it's a Tosefta. Tosefta are teachings from the times of the Mishnah that were not included in the Mishnah, so we're talking about 0 to 200 CE. And they're collected in this parallel work called the Tosefta, which means the extras. So the Tosefta here quotes a number of ideas from Rabbi Akiva and his kind of posse, and then a dissenting view. So going back to Mount Sinai, to the golden calf, the verse in Shmot chapter 31 says that the nation sat down to eat and drink, Vayakumu letzachek, and then they stood up to play.
Wait, was it tzadik or
tzadi? The same exact same root. They stood up to play. If you see here, I highlighted a few terms in source 4. This is Tosefta in Tractate Sota, chapter 6, Tosefta 3. And so, one opinion, this is the one offered by Rabbi Akiva, is, what does tzachok mean in our verse about Yishmael? Just as tzachok in Exodus means they got up, they drank, they ate, probably got drunk, and what did they immediately do? They worshipped an idol. Must mean that tzachok here also means, what does it mean that Yishmael was, quote, playing around? He was actually dabbling with idol worship. And they kind of give this example. I tried to translate it the best I can, that it shows you that Sarah, our foremother, could see the truth, basically. Sarah saw the truth. And what did she see? She saw that Yishmael was building altars. Tzad Chagavim was hunting grasshoppers. I don't know why that's...
Which are kosher, by the way.
Some of which are kosher. Right? There's four-legged and six-legged. And either way you do this, this next part is not kosher. Umale umaktir lavoda kochavim. And he would bring them up and kind of bring them as an offering for idolatry. So opinion number one, what is it that Yishmael did wrong in our rabbinic tradition?
Idolatry.
So idolatry is pretty bad, right? How bad was Yishmael according to the rabbis? Very, very, very bad, right? And what if you want to tag on bad upon bad upon bad, now that you got to idolatry, what else ranks in similar spheres in terms of... So what else is it?
Murder.
Murder?
And sexual impropriety.
Adultery, sexual impropriety, right? The Arayot. So?
They're talking about a nation that's well known to be very
We're not talking about a nation now.
Okay.
We're talking about an individual. I just want to be clear.
Okay.
Right? The confluence of Yishmael with the nation is something that we can save for the end.
Okay.
So that's number one. What did Yishmael do bad when he was mitzachek? Worshiped idols. Opinion number two is, and this is a fascinating textual source, is Genesis 39. Genesis 39 is when the wife of Potiphar kind of outs Yosef and tries to get him in trouble for having been in the same room as her. And she basically goes out, and what does she say? Ba'i lai ha'eved, the slave came upon me, litzachek bi. What did he try to do? Tried to play with me. Right? But what, in essence, she's saying there is, he tried to sleep with a married woman. And the takeaway here is, just as the accusation from the wife of Potiphar, the word mitzachek means inappropriate sexual activity, right? So too, what is it that Yishmael did? And this is a midrash, this part of the Tosefta gets quoted in other contexts. Sarah, our foremother, sees that Yishmael was hiding in gardens and basically like jumping upon and sexually assaulting or raping even women. That's what the Tosefta says as opinion number two. Opinion number three, because we're trying to get to the trifecta here, the rabbis see this as like the trinity of like evil in Yishmael. What else could he have done? He could have murdered. Where do you see this? This is a little bit more obscure. This is in Shmuel Bet in 2 Samuel, where there are two generals, one of King David, one of King David's opponent, Avner and Yoav. And basically, they're in the midst of the story. They have their soldiers basically do war games, I think. Is that the term? They have their people do war games against each other. And the term that's used there is Vaisachku. There it's with the sin and not with the tzaddi, but they have their soldiers play in front of them, and what happens? Some of the soldiers die. And from here, the Midrash, now quoting Rabbi Yishmael, says, what is Yishmael guilty of? Just like there, the game or the war, the playing around was actually murder or killing. So to here, the playing around was killing. And then finally, it teaches us, top of the next page, that Sarah, our foremother, and this is a very strong one, saw Yishmael taking a bow and arrow, keshet v'chitzim, and aiming them, or possibly actually triggering them, klapei Yitzchak, towards Isaac. And here the Midrash, it's the most powerful image that they're kind of planting into the story, which is little baby Yitzchak is probably just crawling around for the first time on his, you know, on his knees and hands. And what's his big brother doing? Using him for target practice. Yeah. That's the Midrash here. Okay. The first three opinions are an extremely, extremely negative view of Yishmael. And then at the end, there's the other opinion, who is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. I think it's interesting. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is coming to criticize his teacher, Rabbi Akiva, now. Rabbi Akiva is sometimes, there's debates among the rabbis in the world of Midrash. And Rabbi Akiva is known as the most expansive interpreter. It's just like methodologically, Rabbi Akiva takes this really wide, expansive view of interpretation. And I think it's interesting that his own primary student, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who in the mystical tradition is the father of Jewish mysticism, but he kind of says, you know what? I have a different interpretation of what this means, and I think mine is better. Might be criticizing his teacher, Rabbi Akiva, for being too expansive. And this is the top of the second page. It says, and I say, right, and I apologize here for my translation, I'm just going to read this in Hebrew. This is the third line in Hebrew, third line in English. So what do I say? Ein tzchok ha'amor kan ela le'inyan Yerusha. What does the laughter or the playing around here have to do with? It only has to do with inheritance. Because when Yitzchak was born to Avraham, everyone was joyful, and everyone was saying, Nolad ben li Avraham, Nolad ben li Avraham. A son has been born to Avraham. A son has been born to Avraham. You can already hear, by the way, in Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's kind of commentary in his Midrashic editions, how would you feel if you were Yishmael in that moment, if everyone's celebrating the birth of Avraham? And at least one version of this Midrash doubles it. Right? So not only are they happy, but they're like just repeating it again and again and again. So here's how he paints this picture or paints or explains the story. So people are saying a son born to Avraham, a son born to Avraham. Nochel et ha'olam, he will inherit this world. It's like a very strong, that expression on its own is shocking. He'll inherit the world. Maybe this is going to the idea that one who creates, saves a soul is as if they saved an entire world. And in the Midrash tradition, Avraham and Sarah were bringing people to monotheism. They're kind of creating souls and therefore creating worlds. So he's going to...
Could certainly be
hyperbole here. No tell shnei chalakim, but the next part is he is going to take a double portion. Double portion is something reserved for firstborn sons and not secondborn sons. But now they're saying, this secondborn is actually the primary son, right? And he's going to take two portions. And what does Yishmael say? V'haya Yishmael mitzachek. Yishmael laughed it off. What did Yishmael say? He just said, bidata, he would laugh it off in his mind and say, al tahi shotim, don't be stupid. Don't be stupid. I'm the firstborn. I'm going to receive the double portion. And at the end of the day, this is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai speaking, commenting on his own interpretation. He says, at the end of the day, you can actually see that I'm right. Why? Because when Sarah kicks out Yishmael and Hagar for the second time, what's the justification she gives? The justification she gives is ki lo yirash ben ha'ama azot, because this son of a maidservant will not inherit along with my child. And so that's how Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai disagrees with the other stream of thinking. The other stream of thinking says, what is mitzachek? What is it, this laughing that Yishmael is known for at a young age? It's like all these bad things, all these sins. And his response is, no, it's actually Yishmael responding, kind of trying to laugh off what you can imagine was an extremely tense situation of who is actually going to have the rights of the firstborn. You want to talk about parallels between Yishmael and Esav, right? What Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai did just now is create a much stronger parallel between the two characters.
It was also like Yosef and his brothers, too, you know, because it was obvious that Yosef was favored.
Yeah.
And he rubbed it in and his brothers turned against him.
Yosef and his brother, I feel, is even more complicated because there's so many other factors going on there that I just want to keep zoomed in on the lens of these two brothers for now. So one thing that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, this is the fourth reading in this Tosefta, has done, right, is that now the Yishmael Yitzchak story is a lot about inheritance, right? And actually, that makes it far more similar to the Esav Yaakov story. So in terms of kind of setting up these paradigm stories, the stories as similar paradigms.
You don't just mean wealth. You mean the Greek also.
I just read the Tosefta. I don't want to kind of put in my commentary yet. I'll get there. I do have something to say about it. But I think it is interesting that, to me, this reads as a comment about who is going to inherit the funds and the wealth and the resources of Avraham's family. And it seems to be a tension now. Right? What is Sarah upset about? Simple reading of this fourth opinion is she's upset that she wants her son to get the lion's share of the inheritance. Right? And that's the tension between Hagar and Sarah. By the way, just from a simple, like, interpersonal... Unfortunately, as a rabbi, I can think of a lot of situations where siblings are torn apart by financial struggles. And who's going to inherit? And how are you going to divide inheritance? Right? This is a very old story, if you're thinking about just the Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai reading of it. Okay. Zooming back, just to kind of think of the Tosefta as a whole, and then we'll move on. There's two streams of thought of Yishmael, right? One is Yishmael is kicked out because Yishmael is evil. That's the first kind of three opinions we saw about Spill. He's a murderer, he's an idolater, he's an adulterer, or maybe even a rapist. That's probably the simplest reading of this. Very, very evil person. That seems to be the first camp of in this Tosefta. And the second camp is, who is Yishmael? Yishmael's a human being who's having a family struggle and a family conflict. Two very different ways of looking at Yishmael. I'll say that in the Midrashic kind of world, it's the first camp that wins, for the most part. Ishmael is just constantly referred to again and again as just an evil figure. I will say that if you do view Ishmael as evil, the Ramban does something really important here. And this, I saw this Ramban probably 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, and I've always found it really powerful. And what the Ramban basically says, this is source 5 on chapter 16, verse 6 of Bereishit, is that, you know what? The fact, if Ishmael ends up becoming an evil person or an enemy of the descendants of Yitzchak, we kind of have to take responsibility for that. Because despite the fact that Hagar may have started treating Sarah not nicely, right? And that is in the text itself. Well, Hagar and Avram also had a role to play and also held responsibility for this family breakdown. And this is what the Ramban says. This is not my translation. Uli, do you want to read it for us? Source 5?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I oppressed her and she fled from her presence, literally faced. Or mother sinned in this oppression, and also Abraham in committing her to do so. And Hashem heard her, Hagar's oppression, gave her a son who would be white as of a man to oppress the descendants of Abraham and Sarah in all kinds of oppression.
Okay. It's like a power. It's a powerful Ramban. Right? The Ramban's saying, like, if now he is categorizing this much more in a battle between the nations, because it's the Zera Avraham. It's like the descendants of Avraham and Sarah. If we're given difficult times because of Ishmael, then it's our fault, or not our fault. It's actually Avraham and Sarah who hold some responsibility for it. And I think this is such an important Ramban for many reasons. I just want to highlight how important it is that our commentaries, and not just like obscure commentaries, but someone essential to our tradition as Nachmanides, is willing to call out a forefather and a foremother for not having behaved properly. And I think that's a really just important statement that we don't believe in angels. In our Bible is not made of angels. Our Bible is made of human beings who lived real human lives, and that's something that even the Ramban acknowledges here. In terms of parenting challenges, right, the Ramban's basically saying that Avraham and Sarah made a mistake, right? And they should have realized that when you're going to afflict a co-wife in this family, one of the parents in this family dynamic, that is going to have really negative implications for the behavior and the relationship of the sons, right? There's no way, I think this is an important lesson, right?
Everybody suffers.
Right, when there's parental conflict, children suffer. I think that's a way you can read this Ramban. And we're actually going to see a later commentary take a similar view in terms of showing responsibility on the side of the parents when it comes to the next generation too. For now, let's go down and think about whether there's any redemption for Ishmael in our rabbinic tradition. So in our rabbinic tradition, I think, Sheldon, you brought this verse up earlier. The chapter 25, verse 9, is after the death of Avraham, who comes to bury him. And what the rabbis notice is, right, brothers separated by their parents' actions are reunited in chapter 25, verse 9. And so, Sheldon, do you want to read that for us?
His sons, Yitzhak and Ishmael, buried him in the chamber of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar, the Hittite, facing Mamre.
Okay, great. So one thing that's interesting here is that Ishmael and Esav are listed together. I think it's important to note the order, right? Because now Yitzhak gets listed before Ishmael. Does that mean that this is an acknowledgement of the place of the two brothers? Maybe. I think the Talmud reads it that way, that like this was Ishmael acknowledging that Yitzhak is the spiritual heir.
He's ours.
That he is always?
Ours.
Our tradition, certainly, right? I'm sure the Quran probably does not say that. Okay, what happens next, and this is a fascinating piece in Talmud, is that before Avraham dies, one chapter earlier, we're told that Avraham was old and God blessed Avraham bakol, with everything, right? And what is everything? And the next piece in the Talmud kind of goes back here and gives gives five or six different interpretations of what everything means. One of them is that he got married to another woman whose name was Bakol, which is like interesting. I thought that was like fun. There's some more difficult interpretations, but the two that are central to our story, and again, this is the rabbis trying to understand the juxtaposition of narratives, trying to read very carefully into the text of the Torah itself. And what do the rabbis say? The rabbis give two different interpretations here in Baba Batra 16b. Kirsten, do you want to read this for us? Source 7. If you want to pass.
Alternatively, what is the blessing of Bachol? That Esau did not rebel in Abraham's lifetime. That is to say, as long as Abraham lived, Esau did not sin. Alternatively, the blessing of Bachol is that Ishmael repented in Abraham's lifetime.
So I'll just pause you there, sorry, if that's okay. So two different opinions here, right? And both of them seem to understand the end of Avram's life as like a chapter heading, right? It ends one part of a story and begins another.
Why are we talking about Esau in the context of Abraham?
We'll get there.
Okay.
We'll get there. So opinion, let me start with the Ishmael repenting opinion. The Ishmael repenting opinion is actually, the textual proof from it is source 6 that we just read before. That Ishmael and Yitzchak find themselves together. That's a deep connection. Right? The fact that they can be in the same room as they bury their father seems to say that there was some reconciliation. Now, if you take the Midrashic reading that what was the whole conflict was about Ishmael being a sinner, then how can they be in the same room? It must be that Ishmael had repented for his sins. That's kind of one approach. The other approach is that there's actually no reconciliation between the conflict that existed between these brothers.
Wait, there was a conflict between Yitzhak and Ishmael? I don't remember any reference to that.
The fact that here Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's reading of the Tosefta is that there was difficulty around who would get the inheritance, that suggests that there was a conflict, even if it's not explicit in the verses. I hear your point. Okay. Now let's go to this other point of Esav, right? Esav didn't sin until Avram died. What's the proof of that? I'll just start for the sake of time, actually. I'm going to say this outside, right? This is the story of Esav. So now we're transitioning to story number two, right? Esav comes back from the field, and he's very hungry. And what is Yaakov cooking? Right, some redness that
lentils.
Our commentaries say, right, Rashi and others say, is lentils. And Rashi asks, well, why lentils? And the answer is because lentils are a morning meal. It's a meal of mourning. What's the mourning that's going on? The mourning is that Avram died. And why? How can you read that into the psukim? It happens to be one chapter is Avram's death, and the next chapter is the birth of Esav and Yaakov. So it kind of happens one right after the other. They're juxtaposed against each other. So that's what the Talmud says here. I'm just going to read on your behalf for the bottom part here. Right? Esav came in from the field, and he is ayef, he is tired. And our opinion in the Talmud is, from the Braita, right, on the day that Avram passed away, right, Yaakov made a lentil stew to comfort Yitzchak, his father. His father is sitting Shiva, presumably, in the Midrashic mind. And that's when Esav goes off. What do you mean? How do you know Esav went off on that day? Who said Esav went off? And so this is kind of our next question. Here it's the Talmud just said, right, the day that Avraham died, or at least the day that Avraham was buried, is the day that Esav becomes evil, right? Or that is the day that Esav, the Talmud language is marat, is that Esav rebelled. How do I know that that's the day that Esav rebelled? And the answer seems to be, and I'm sorry that I didn't quote these verses inside. If we were to really do this in the proper way, we would have to like read the psukim from multiple chapters in Tanakh. But I'm trying to kind of give more of a summary arc for how you can understand this. So what happens on the day that Yaakov is cooking the lentils? Esav comes in, says, I'm really hungry. Yaakov says, I'll feed you on one condition.
Right? I take the birthright.
Right, sell me your birthright.
Oh, he's probably thinking about this because of the death of his grandfather, Cain.
That's interesting. Okay, I like the connections you're making there. But what? Esav says, "I'm going to die." I think that's the language. I'm not going to quote.
Yeah.
If I don't eat, I'll die. And what is this birthright good for me if I'm not going to live? And then that verse ends with the Esav bizez et habichora. Bizat. Oh, I should really have this. Let me not. Sorry, Rabbi. This would be chapter 26 in Bereishit. Instead of misquoting things, it's better to get them right first time around. Anyone know? I think we're in chapter 26. Perfect. So this is, it's chapter 25, verse 31. Yaakov says, "Sell me your firstborn rights." Verse 32. Behold, I'm about to die. For what good is this birthright for me? Yaakov says, "Swear to me today," and he swore to him. And he sold his firstborn rights to Yaakov. Verse 34. And Yaakov gave to Esav bread and this lentil stew. And he ate and he drank and he stood and he went. And Esav was bozeh, debased, insulted, made an embarrassment of the firstborn rights. Okay.
Was the food like a kinyan? The food itself?
That's an interesting question. I don't want to get into the laws of kinyanim right now, but it's an interesting thought. Let me just kind of state here what the Gemara is going to suggest. The Gemara suggests that it's that moment that Esav, it's not just that he sells the firstborn, it's that he embarrassed the firstborn that leads the rabbis of the Talmud to say he really went off and rebelled. It's something about the sale of the firstborn. It was more than just, I don't want to be firstborn anymore. Right? It wasn't just, you take that double portion if you want it. There's something deeper that the rabbis pick up on. And just to highlight how far the rabbis go, because when I asked you, in the eyes of the Midrash, how bad are these figures? And the answer was very, very, very bad. It turns to the top of the third page. Rabbi Yochanan says, that wicked Esav on that day committed five transgressions on that day that Avram died. He engaged in sexual intercourse with a married woman. He killed a person. He denied the principle of God's existence. He denied resurrection of the dead. And he despised the birthright. How bad was Esav according to the Midrash?
Very, very, very.
Very, very, very bad. And all of that coming from just the term of Vayivez et Bechora. So first of all, you can tell here that the rabbis very much do appreciate, they think the Bechora, the firstborn rights, are extremely important, right? And so somehow they're willing to take from Esav rejecting the Bechora a huge slew of things. And if anything, if you're just comparing the Gemara for Esav to the Tosefta about Yishmael, it's even like, you thought Yishmael was bad, but Esav adds to that, denying the resurrection of the dead. Seems to be, how's that connected to the Bechora? It's kind of like saying, I'm about to die, and saying, then that's it. There's nothing after that. Mm.
There is more evidence that he's bad, though, because Yaakov is afraid of him. And I think that is evidence that he might have been dead.
So the fact that he tries to kill Yaakov and Yaakov runs away from his life is definitely an explicit part of the narrative that you see with Esav that you did not see with Ishmael. Mm-hmm. That's true. I want to now kind of go on and talk about the parenting challenges in this third generation of the forefathers. Mm-hmm. Right, so this is Yaakov who's struggling to... Sorry, this is Yitzchak, second generation, trying to raise the third generation. So this is Yitzchak and Rivka trying to raise Yaakov and Esav. And one of the first things you see in Rashi is that when they are born, we're actually not told much about them. And then a few verses later, it says that they grew up. Vayigdalu hanarim, the boys grew up. And then Esav became a man of hunting. And Yaakov was an ish tam yoshevo alim, a simple person who sat in tents. That's the description. And I just want to point out something interesting in Rashi, though, which is that Rashi says you're not told anything about them until you're told that they grew up. And I never noticed this Rashi before, but I think there's something powerful. And this is source 8. This is Rashi on chapter 25, verse 27. Rashi says, "Kol zman shehayu ketanim, as long as the children were young, lo hayu nikarim b'maaseihem. No one noticed anything about their actions. Ve'ein adam medak deik b'hem mativam. And no one was like being careful to see what is their nature. Kevan shenasu b'nei shalosh esrei shana. But once they became bar mitzvah, 13 years old, which is not just adult age responsible for mitzvah, is also, in Chazal's view, a moment of like human maturity. Zeb hiresh lebatei midrashot. This one separated to the houses of study. Vizeb hiresh le'avodah zarah. And that one separated and went off to the houses of idolatry.
But they were always talking inside the womb.
Yeah, that's okay. Right. Yeah.
Great. So this is, the Torah text itself says that Rivka saying, like, I can't handle this pregnancy, right? And then she's told in a prophecy that there are two nations within your womb, and they're going to be kind of pursuing each other, right? But it doesn't tell us why they're arguing. And now we're kind of reading back to the beginning and saying, what was the cause of the argumentation? The cause of the argumentation is that they had two different natures. But we only found out about it 13 years later. Mm-hmm. Right? We didn't know about it at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I would have never made this connection myself. But I think there's something amazingly powerful, and it's a critique. It's a parenting lesson and a critique of Rivka and Yitzchak, offered by Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. Rabbi Hirsch always says something fascinating. And let's read what he has to say. Don, do you want to read that for us?
Sure.
Source 9.
The striking contrast in the grandchildren of Abraham may have been due not so much to a difference in their temperaments as to a mistake in the way they were brought up. No attention was paid to their differences while they were little. Both were given the same teaching and educational treatment. Had Yitzhak and Rivka studied the nature of Esau and spoken to that nature, who can say how different the history of the ages may have been recorded?
It's like a powerful critique of their parenting. And I think Rabbi Hirsch is basing himself on that Rashi, on that, or at least that Midrashic idea that's quoted in Rashi, which is, they didn't notice who their kids were until they were 13 years old. Mm. They waited too long to kind of pay attention to them.
But they also played favorites, too.
The favorites happen after this point, if you're just going through the verses. So, okay, the Midrash adds lots of other things here, too. I'll just point out one of them, and this is the second piece in Rashi and Source 8, which is, Esav is described as an ish yodei atzait, a man who knows hunting. This is after they grow up. Esav is a man who knows hunting. And it's a kind of odd statement to make. Why not just say that he is an ish tzait, a man of hunting? What's added by that term if he knows hunting? He's someone who knew hunting. And Rashi quotes another just astounding midrash. And there's so many rabbinic kind of stories baked into the story that we assume for ourselves. I always like have a very hard time separating out these midrashim because I've just been learning them for so long. But what Rashi says is, what does it mean he knows hunting? It's that he's cunning about something to do with hunting. He knows things about hunting. And what does it say? He knows how to hunt and how to cheat his father with his mouth. And how did he do it? He would say, Abba, Father, how do we separate tithes from salt and from straw? That's one of the examples given in the Midrash. The Midrash paints Esav as someone who knows enough to make his father think that he is a very pious, learned Jew. The fact that, like, are people separating tithes at this point in Jewish history? Like, that's a whole separate discussion. We talked about that yesterday morning in a class I did at OHGS. But for now, we're assuming that he did keep the mitzvah, or at least they knew about the mitzvah. And he's saying, can a person, what's the law of separating tithes for salt and for straw? Anyone familiar with the answer to that question? Tithing is only a mitzvah on produce that people eat, right? For salt is not produce, it's not grown, it's a deposit in the ground, it's a mineral. And straw is not used for people, so therefore it's not obligated in tithing. So what's, at least in the Midrashic mind, Esav doing? Esav is yodea. He's like cunning and smart and knows how to get his father on his side. parenthetically, it's obvious in the psukim that Yitzhak must have enjoyed a good steak, right? Because Yitzhak very much appreciates his son. If you look at just at the simple reading of the verses, it says that Yitzhak loved his son because there was meat in his mouth, and Rivka loved Yaakov. Yitzhak's love for his son is given a descriptive term or a justification because they like meat, right? And Rivka is not given a descriptive term. It seems to be, at least in a simple reading, that Yitzhak is swayed by his son's natural abilities, which are delicious, right? Like, it's like having a cook, it's like having like a 5-star chef at home who knows how to procure the best ingredients. But Rashi takes it a step further and says that Yitzhak is impressed by Esav, who's not only a good hunter but a cunning person, and knew how to make his father think that he was committed to their tradition. Okay, so I want to kind of share very quickly different contemporary approaches for how to think about this whole parsha, this whole kind of discussion of these evil figures, and what is it that our tradition is so concerned about in the rabbinic reading of these people. So one is from a Rosh Yeshiva at the Gush, Yeshiva Har Tzion, Rabbi Baruch Gigi, and he actually goes back to the Tosefta about the Tosefta that suggests that what is it that Yishmael did so bad? That Yishmael played around with the question of inheritance. Remember that end of the Tosefta? The end of the Tosefta says that what's mitzachek, what is it? And by the way, the goal here that I'm trying to do is to show that if you understand the first generation, then you can also come to understand the second generation. We'll just do quick two approaches for how to do that. So Rabbi Gigi says that what is it that Yishmael was really being mitzachek about, that he was really playing around with? It's that his focus in that midrash is, don't that celebration that's happening for my newborn half-brother, right? They're not going to win. That's not really going to happen. I'm still going to get the shnei chalakim, the two portions. This is an interesting reading, but I think if it's not a literal one, it has a deep beauty to it. What Sarah really couldn't handle was that all that Yishmael cared about was the material side of the right of the firstborn and not the spiritual side of the right of the firstborn. That what was Yishmael being mitzachek, what was he kind of putting down or playing down? He was playing down, oh, I don't have to worry, I'm still going to get the double portion. What deeply upset her, and this is eventually, this is Rabbi Gigi's reading, what causes Sarah to kick her stepson out of the house is that he only cared about the material side of the Bechora, of the firstborn rights, and not about the spiritual side of the firstborn rights. The fact that it was really the firstborn's job to perpetuate everything that Avraham had created, which was ethical monotheism, which was doing acts of kindness and creating an open tent for people in need. Interestingly, it's Yitzchak, right, the son who she does keep close to her father, to his father. But Yitzchak's identity is exactly that and nothing more. Right? Yitzchak's primary identity is just to maintain the tradition that Avram created. But that's Yitzchak who redigs the wells of his father. He doesn't create anything new. He just restores that which was already there. Yitzchak, apparently, this is Rabbi Gigi's reading, valued the Bechora because of its spiritual meaning and not because of its material meaning. And that's what Sarah was so focused on. When you come and read it from that perspective, then you can also understand the conflict between Yaakov and Esav. I'm not sure that the Midrashim would say that Esav was like the worst person on earth. I'm not sure that that's meant to be interpreted literally. But what I do think it's trying to highlight is a similar problem, which is that Esav, as a character, is only concerned about the material life that exists right now and has no concern about the spiritual values that need to be maintained and, if anything, enhanced in future generations. Right? How do you read this into the verses? Right? It's Esav who says, if I die, what purpose is this right of the firstborn? Let me eat instead. And he's focused on his material sustenance and not on his spiritual continuity.
And right now, he's interested in what's immediate.
Yeah, there's definitely an interest in immediacy. I'll point, this is something I thought was amazing from Rabbi Yair, Rabbi Ari Khan. Rabbi Ari Khan points out a midrash about the name Esav. Right? Esav means he is made. From like Asa or Asui, he is made made. Esav is born looking like a fully grown man, right, with already hair on his hands, right? Esav was born the way that Esav would continue to live. There was no development, no maturation in Esav. Right? He cared about what he had then, and he wasn't a person who was capable of being forward-looking, of thinking into the future. And maybe that's the kind of tension between Esav and Yaakov. And maybe you could say that Rivka, right, says it has to be Yaakov, even if it comes to chicanery and cheating, who continues because Yaakov is someone who sits in the tent. But Yaakov is not as focused in the momentary, but on sitting and learning so that he can be, know in the future. Let's move on to one final approach.
It sounded like the couch potato when it first mentioned sitting in tents, you know, not
right.
Learning.
You have to use the rabbinic tradition there to say that the idea of sitting in a tent is sitting and studying Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see how we can do this. The second idea from Rabbi Yair Ari Khan, I thought this was really insightful, is that Yitzchak, remember we just said Yitzchak as a personality, is someone who is trying to maintain that which was. Yitzchak is trying to maintain Abraham's legacy. He has a fascinating insight, which is that Yitzchak is not only focused just on Abraham, Yitzchak is actually focused, and I thought this was fascinating, on trying to repair the broken relationships of his father's generation. I found this absolutely like an incredible idea. How do you see this? So the first thing is that Yitzchak and Ishmael do reunite, at least when it comes to burying their father. Right? In our rabbinic idea, there is a rapprochement that happens between Yitzchak and Ishmael. But furthermore, I found this amazing. When Yitzchak meets Rivka, okay, when Rivka's coming on the camels, right? Eliezer has found Rivka. Where does Rivka meet Yitzchak?
No.
It is
in Eretz
Canaan. It is back in Canaan at a specific place, and that place is Be'er Lachai Ro'i, the well of Lachai Ro'i. Where is Be'er Lachai Ro'i? Where is that well? That is the well that Hagar traveled to when she was kicked out of Avram's home with Yishmael. Now, Rashi quotes this midrash and asks, what was Yitzchak doing at Be'er Lachai Ro'i, the same well that we last saw in the story of Hagar and Yishmael?
Visiting his
brother. So Rashi says, and it's an amazing midrash that he's quoting from Breishit Rabbah, that Yitzchak was back to find Hagar, who had been kicked out presumably decades earlier, and bring her back to remarry Avraham. And that's the Midrashic's reading, that Avraham's final wife of Keturah is actually Hagar. So I think the idea that Avraham, according to the Midrash, remarries Hagar is not something that I've heard before. What I've never heard before, that it's actually Yitzchak who makes the shidduch. That Yitzchak went back to Be'er Lachai Ro'i, revisiting the place of his stepmother and stepbrothers and half-brothers' trauma, and brings Hagar back from there in Rashi, right? According to Rashi in the Midrash, brings Hagar back from there to rekindle a relationship with her ex-husband.
It's interesting you said rekindle, because the name Keturah could mean incense.
That is very interesting. Yeah. And here's what Rabbi Ari Khan says, that Yitzchak was trying to repair the mistakes of the previous generation. He was actually trying not only to come close to his brother again, but to actually bring his father and his stepmother back together again as well, because he regretted the conflict that had happened. And that influences Yitzchak when it comes to his own parenting decisions. Because when it comes to his own parenting decisions, Yitzchak sees he has two sons, one who is more aligned with Yitzchak, and one who, at least in the Midrashic mind, is far more similar to Ishmael. And what does he try to do? He tries to overcompensate in his parenting and love Ishmael far more and give Ishmael special favor, right? And that, I thought that was an amazing kind of idea, that maybe the reason that Yitzchak has this blind love of Esav, despite the fact that Esav, particularly through the Midrashim, is not the best of figures, is because he's actually trying to make up for the mistakes of the previous generation. I think it's interesting, though, that sometimes if you're only focused on repairing the past, you get blinded to the present, too. Right? And he was probably overcompensating and not willing to see certain flaws that existed in Esav. Okay. I'll just end with a final idea. There's an amazing midrash that I had a hard time finding, but I eventually got there. It says that there are four kinds of names. This is source 12. You can read it for yourselves later. That there are four kinds of names. There are nice-sounding names with nice actions. The assumption here is that a person's name is influenced often, more often than not, a person's name influences their behavior. So there are people with nice names and nice actions, people with ugly names and nice actions, people with ugly names and ugly actions, and people with, which one did I forget? People with ugly names and nice actions. I think I left that one out. And the Midrash says, who are people with Shemot Na'im Umaseh Mechorim, with beautiful names but disgusting actions? And the answer it gives to is Esav and Ishmael. Esav, because he is Oseh, he's Asui, made, but is not Oseh, doesn't make for himself. And Ishmael, who heard, who is Shama, but is not Shomea, doesn't hear. And what the Midrash seems to be suggesting is that Esav and Yaakov in our tradition are people who had kind of great spiritual potential and didn't live up to that potential. They were born with these incredibly holy names and didn't actualize what was coded into those names. We'll hold with that point now for tonight. But I think when we go back to these stories, first of all, there's beauty and benefit to trying to read them on their own without caking in the Midrash right away, without kind of only looking at them through the Midrashic lens. There's also benefit to understanding that the Midrashim are based in ideas in the Pesukim and the verses themselves, and are trying to give life to those verses. And there's a huge amount of responsibility to go around. That if we do interpret these as the ultimate bad guys of the Torah, that there's responsibility that has to be held by, say, the other side of the equation, by their parents, by their step-parents. These mistakes and these difficulties are something that we have to contend with ourselves. And hopefully we can learn from the lessons not only of the heroes of our Torah, but also from the anti-heroes, both in understanding their humanity, where they went wrong for themselves, and also in our role in trying to ameliorate some of the mistakes of the past. There's more to say, but we'll hold off for here for now. I'm happy to take any questions, but I realize the hour is late, and anyone who needs to go can do so. So thanks, and have a great night.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.